Welcome to another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. Robin Rice doesn't believe in the status quo, especially when the status quo is not working. She's an author, social thought leader, innovator, who through Rainmaker Consulting provides personal mentoring to artists, healing professionals, and other leaders whose work impacts the lives of others. Robin's company, Be Who You Are Productions, is responsible for a wide range of free creative social change projects like Stop the Beauty Madness campaign. Comprised of more than 25 graphic ads and a free 10-week audio series, it empowered women to say, "We've had it! Enough of the so-called ideal image and impossible standards. The time has come to change the rules of the game." The campaign was seen and heard around the world. There's AwesomeWomenHub.com. Robin and 50 local leaders created a 5-city tour featuring music videos designed to empower women around the world in new feminine models of community. In 2012, Robin founded YourHolidayMom.com, providing LGBTQ young people with a mother's support during holiday time between Thanksgiving and New Year's. It registered 35,000 hits in the first 40 days and is now in its third year. Just recently, she launched the first Be Who You Are app. Her books include a novel, 100 Ways to Sunday, Venus for a Day, Do-Overs, An Irish Story, Is There a Shaman in You?, 7 Things You Must Do to Love Your Life. So now it's time to meet this amazing, passionate, committed woman, Robin Rice. Welcome and thanks for joining me today.
Oh, thank you so much, Sandy. I'm excited to be here.
I'm going to start with this rather large question. Who is Robin Rice?
Oh, wow. Yeah, large question. On one hand, I'm just another person walking the planet. There's so many of us here, and I just have this one little life, and I'm doing everything I can with it. And on another level, I think I'm a voice for those who are disenfranchised in some ways, for those who are hurting and don't know how to put words to what's going on. And I'm a teacher. I'm a teacher of the things that I've learned along the way.
You also are unique in so many other ways. And let's start with the fact that you studied with shamans and you are a shaman. Will you explain that and talk about that?
Sure. So the shaman would have been found in every community throughout history and all parts of the world. We know that from cave paintings and etchings and all of those kinds of things. But the shaman is someone who, I joke a lot that people say, when I started, no one knew what a shaman was, and that was great and it was difficult, but I could explain it. Now everyone thinks they know what a shaman is because we've used it in so many different ways. But really, this person would have been born into the tribe with an unusual skill set, unusual natural abilities, abilities that went beyond, the typical 5 senses. They might have been a healer or a seer or a warrior in unique ways. And they would have been pulled aside as a child and said, this is your role. This is the role you'll play in our community. And even though we don't have that in our culture today, we still have people being born with these abilities and born with these inclinations. And so the contemporary shaman for me is saying, well, what do we do with these resources that we have? I mean, pretty much most people just poo-poo the soul, poo-poo the whole, is there anything more? And yet inside, many people know there's something more. So how do we bridge that? And then how do we serve our community? So I think things like, Stop the Beauty Madness and the other projects that I do are my way of saying, I don't ever have to tell you I'm a shaman, but I need to do the work of healing the community as a shaman.
But how did you know that you were a shaman? And apparently this was something that came into your life when you were a child, a young child.
I was one of those people who didn't have any context for it. When I was 5, the traumatic story is that my favorite babysitter was pushed out of a car and killed. And I went to the funeral home and I saw things that I wasn't supposed to be able to see. And of course, when you're 5, you don't know that everybody can't see it. And then no one understood what I was talking about. I was seeing daggers flying. I could see who had done it, or I believed I could see who had done it, even though I didn't even know you know, that that was a question in the air, because I wasn't, no, none of those things were explained to me. So then the question is, well, what do you do with that? And so for the most part, I put it away. And it wasn't until I was 35, when I had a very sudden spiritual awakening, that I came back to, wow, this thing has been here all along. And no, not everybody can do this. So how do I make sense of it? And I spent about 7 years reading every book I could. All day long, I read everything, Eastern traditions, I read mysticism, I read everything I could find to try to figure out what this was.
So it kind of lay dormant in your mind, your psyche, your life for 30 years?
Yeah, it really did.
But did you have other similar experiences? Hopefully they weren't traumatic ones, like the loss of a babysitter. But in the course of those decades, did you know that something else was continuing to go on in you?
Well, I'm not entirely sure that I did know. I knew that something was different. I certainly knew that I was different. But, you know, everybody feels different, right, from everybody else.
Sure.
So there's, you know, all of us have those kinds of feelings. So how do you tease that out? And I did end up having quite a few more traumatic experiences. You know, my two best friends died within a month of each other when I was 9. There were many other deaths. I lost a brother. I lost, you know, other people that were close to me. So, and I found out later in life that this is actually very common for those who are on the shamanic path, that they have very deep experiences with death. And this is part of their teaching. So when I learned that, everything kind of clicked. And I said, okay, this is a path that's going to show me, make some sense of this history of mine and these abilities and put it all together.
Which is interesting, because it could go the other way, as in, oh my God, this is so horrible. What's happening around me? And you could just do a complete 180.
Well, at first I did. I mean, I really believed that I killed people.
Really?
No, I really did. I really thought that whatever it was that I had was very, very dangerous and bad. And so, you know, again, in our culture, these kind of conversations just weird people out. And so they don't take it seriously. And so now, you know, now I teach, you know, I have apprentices each year, and I teach them, you know, what is it that we actually do have? What's real about it? Instead of just brushing it off and saying, you know, I mean, I'm a smart woman. I tell people this all the time. I'm a smart woman, and I would not do this if it didn't work, because that would just be crazy.
Exactly. But it just it seems so interesting that you were able to kind of incorporate it into your life.
Well, now it is my life.
It is your life. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that you experienced this awakening when you're 35. You felt that you could see everything in the universe, or am I putting words in your mouth?
I honestly, my very first response was to look up into the sky and say, it took you long enough. I cannot believe you let me believe this was real for 35 years. What were you thinking?
Did you tell anybody? Did you have a confidant, somebody that you could pour your heart out to?
Well, I think by that time, I certainly had good friends, and I certainly had people. They all thought it was very strange too. But once the awakening happened, everything changed. I was fortunate to have one of those, you know, as far as I can tell, completely undeserved, instantaneous, that was then, this is now. And that this is now was that, you know, I mean, I had a pretty horrific, you know, growing up life. So I spent most of my life wishing I wasn't alive.
Yeah.
And then from that at 35, from then on, to never feel that way again, ever. To never feel like it wasn't amazing to be alive. Is that's just remarkable.
Did you study with anybody? Who was your quote mentor?
Yeah, I studied with a lot of people in small ways. I traveled around the world. I met with different shamans. I took trips. I learned from other people who were teaching some degree of contemporary shamanism as well as native. But really, you know, this is where it gets really crazy, is I was taught in my dreams. So I would go to sleep and I would have a dream, and then I would wake up and I would have these beings of some kind, I can't really describe, explain everything to me about how it was and how it fit into the universe and what it meant and all of these things. And then I would really wake up, and I would have sworn I was awake. I would have sworn I was in the room with someone, but I wasn't. I was still asleep. And after a while, I began to realize, you know what? Something's going on here. And again, I'm a smart woman. I realize it sounds really crazy, mm-hmm. but when it happens over and over and over again, you can't deny it. You just have to go with it.
And so you went with it.
I did.
Which means what?
Which means that I started learning about these deeper, you know, experiences in the universe and in our lives and how we are not bound by this consensus reality. And that there's so much more. And yet at the same time, it's completely relevant to our psyches as we know it, as the average everyday person's psyche is filled with magnificence, you know, the creative, your work is with the creative women. The creative life is not completely different from what I'm talking about. There's a lot of parallels in there. And so bringing that forward and saying, look, maybe this is somehow our evolution. This is where we're going, what's possible. And so I'm asking far more questions than I have answers for, but I think they're better and better questions.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Robin Rice, an internationally published author, an online teacher, a social thought leader, and a mentor. Robin, let's follow your career a little bit. You began as a writer, first for international magazines. So what did you write about?
Oh gosh, back then, that was, you know, early. I was an entrepreneur. I had a business when I was younger as well. And then I wrote about whatever was on in my life. I wrote about raising children. I wrote for Sesame Street Parents Guide magazine, video review column with another author. I wrote about whatever it was that was interesting to me at the time. I wrote about sudden infant death syndrome when one of my, another co-author had lost a child, and we felt like that was an important book to write.
So it didn't matter what the topic was. Whatever you felt a strong need, urge, desire is what you put down on paper.
Yes, yes. You know, business consultants find me frustrating that way because I will always just do something different next.
It's so hard to put a label on you, but that's what's so great about it. So how did you transition to books and novels? You just sat down one day and decided, I'm going to write 100 Ways to Sunday?
Well, actually, I was given the book in a journey state, in a shamanic journey state, which I had never been a novelist. I was, you know, I'd written and published nonfiction, and hadn't really planned on being a novelist. And this story just came to me. The whole package of it came to me, and I decided that I had to find a way to write it. And it's interesting because I had only been, you know, quote unquote, awake from this experience a couple of years before it came out. And I think it's probably my best work still to date.
Describe the book.
Well, some wonderful guy, I love stories, so this wonderful guy who was at a wine tasting, I told him about the book, and I said, but we never have any way to categorize it, and he went off, and he came back, and he poured me another glass of wine, and he said, you write postmodern mythology, and I said, damn, I do.
That's a great way to describe it.
It is. It's postmodern mythology. I take some kind of mythological tradition or historical spiritual tradition. I have a person, a woman from a contemporary setting who's going in and says, you know, how is this relevant or engages with it in some way, usually very mysteriously, and goes through her own growth process by engaging in that. So 100 Ways was on the Navajo Reservation. Do-Overs, an Irish Story, was pre-Celtic Ireland. Venus for a Day was obviously Greek mythology. So taking these deeper mythological truths and saying, what happens when you smash that into an average everyday woman's life who's not expecting anything more than, you know, what happened the day before and the day before that?
Right, right.
Then
one of your books, 7 Things You Must Do to Love Your Life. What must I do to love my life?
I think you really have to be on a path. It doesn't matter what the path is. I think you can choose from the smorgasbord of paths that are out there, but you need something that you're moving towards and your inner life is moving towards.
Do I need a direction?
A direction, maybe that's one way to put it. I don't know that you have to say this is a direction, but a path of some sort, some way in which you're moving yourself and growing yourself up. It makes no difference what the path is. Choose whatever one you like. But I believe if you don't have that, you will feel very tossed and turned by this world.
I want to move from your writings to the start of your campaigns. I first want you to describe, for those who never saw Stop the Beauty Madness campaign, describe what the campaign is, but before that, what prompted you to launch it?
I found, as we look at women today, I believe that we have been held back by beauty and body issues more than any other issue that's out there. At least if you're talking about your first world problems. The first world women have education, we have money, we have opportunity, and we worry about our waist size. We worry about what, you know, cream we're putting on our face. We worry about what we look like. And this, I believe, was a systematic way to keep women. I mean, women who are apathetic don't vote. Huh. Women who are apathetic, they don't go for the top of the boardroom. And it's very complex. But the bottom line is that women, and especially our daughters, our younger women, are absolutely paralyzed by beauty and their lack of beauty, or supposed lack of beauty, their lack of their thigh gap, their lack of being able to be good enough to fit in. And they don't become courageous women very easily when that is what they look at every day. And what I found for me, one of the reasons why it was particularly powerful for me, I grew up with a dad who was in, you know, the advertising industry, and he knew it very well, and he taught it to me at a very young age. And my dad would say to me, "My God, Robin, you're just amazing. You have this brilliant mind, and you're so fascinating, and you're so creative. It's too bad you're fat."
Ay, yay, yay.
And I wasn't even a fat girl. I was just not a skinny girl, right? So I grew up with that. And what I found was when I hit my 30s, it hadn't changed. When I hit my 40s, it still bothered me. When I hit my 50s, I'm 52 now. When I hit my 50s, I was pissed.
Yeah.
Why is this still in here? Of all the things, of all the awakening, of all the spirituality, of all the things I've done in the world, why do I care? And that bothered me. So I started exploring it creatively through these ads and saying, look, it's everywhere. It doesn't matter what your nationality is. It doesn't matter what your age is. It doesn't matter what your size is. You're going to have this conversation with your body and with the world if you're a woman. You just are. And it just went everywhere. It was in 100 different countries' media.
What blows my mind, and I've said this kind of ad nauseum, is now it's 2015. And even though your campaign didn't start yesterday, we're still talking about this because it's still such a part of our lives, young women's lives, older women's lives. It doesn't matter. I don't for a minute diminish the potency of this campaign. I just wonder, are we all going to be buried with this, if you know what I mean? Is anything ever going to change?
I think that's a really, really good question. I mean, we're certainly seeing, that's why we did the audio series for the Frontline Voices. And you know, it's very tied up as well in money. You know, when I was interviewed for the Huffington Post Live, before I was actually interviewed live, they actually covered the campaign with a group of women. And one of the first things they said was, "Yeah, but how are they making money on this campaign?" They couldn't believe that I would do it without a profit motive. And there's not been a profit motive. My social change projects are paid for by my other work. This idea that we might do something for some other reason besides money is really a powerful piece of this puzzle. And the question of how, you know, do you want to change this about the beauty industry? Well, we have to change the fact that everybody wants us to feel bad about ourselves so that we become good little consumers. That's the root of what I see. And it's built into our culture, and it's from the youngest ages now. So because it gets in so deeply, the other piece that I feel very strongly about is that we've lost our capacity to see beauty as anything other than a waist size and a skin, you know, type. And the capacity to see beauty in the sunrise, and the capacity to see beauty in nature, and all the different ways that beauty can emerge are second fiddle to what we look like. And this is, I believe, it's very systematic. And I think we're really, at the moment, we're still losing the war on it, but there's a whole lot of people who are starting to talk about this now. And that's important.
But you know what's interesting, when you were saying that people said, well, what's the profit motive here? You were performing a public service.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the beginning and the end of it. It's like an ad council. Don't drink and drive. Don't worry about what you look like. And in that same vein, describe some of the pictures of the women, because it really is stunning.
So you have a young, very, very thin, trendy woman who is saying, I'm not a lucky dog. I'm not anorexic. I'm not sick. I'm thin. It's a body type. So that shows the thin woman's side of this conversation. At the same time, you have a woman who's very large by standard, culture standards, in her underwear on a bicycle, exercise bicycle from the back, and you see her, and it says, what it feels like when you look at me at the gym.
Wow.
And then you have the child that says, what do I want to grow up? What do I want to be when I grow up? Pretty. So we come at it from every possible angle that I could find that actually I could get away with because they were vetted and some of them were too intense for people.
Really?
So didn't get on there because they were too intense.
Like what would be an intense one?
Ones that dealt more with anorexia.
For me, there was a very powerful
one. Eating disorders.
Right, but there was a very powerful one with the older woman. Would you
give
that caption out? Do you remember it?
So there's this older woman who's absolutely gorgeous, probably in her 70s, and she says, I'm not ugly, I'm invisible. And that's really true. We, you know, again, our culture has said once you get to a certain age and a certain look, you're out. We have no respect for you. We don't even see you.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Robin Rice, an internationally published author, an online teacher, a social thought leader, and a mentor. What about 70,000awesomewomenhub.com? What does that mean that you came up with new feminine models of community? Explain that.
It was actually new feminine models of doing business. So this idea that we could do something without a profit motive. When we did the Awesome Women Hub tour, we got five different musicians, or actually some more, but we ended up using five musicians who gifted us with their music so that we could make a music video. And this was very easy music video. This was me with a handheld camera. This was, we spent a day talking about what it meant to be beautiful, what it meant to be empowered. And then we did and created a video together. It was fun. And it cost just enough money to pay for, you know, our expenses. We literally broke even to the dime of the five tours. But what we did was we talked about, well, what about the generosity model of doing business? Can we be generous? Can we lead with our generosity and build something from that as opposed to, I'm not going to do it unless it makes money? And that was one of the themes that we discussed a great deal. And of course, you know, Stop the Beauty Madness came from part of that too.
And then there's your holidaymom.com. What's the genesis of that?
My heart. So Your Holiday Mom is a service that we have to create letters for LGBTQ youth who have not got a mom's love. It just amazes me that any mom could turn away their child because they're gay or transgender. And yet it happens all the time. And our suicide rate is among the highest in transgender and gay young people.
Mm-hmm.
And so we wrote letters and we said, hey, this is what it's like at our house, virtually inviting you to come in. You'll have to sit by Uncle Joe, who's always telling a bad joke, and presents around this, and really making it, you know, showing what our lives are like and saying, we are virtually in our hearts pulling up a seat for you. And it was crazy. We saved lives, many lives. They wrote us in the comments and said, I was going to kill myself tonight and I found this site.
Oh my God.
Many times, not just a few. And some of the heartbreaking comments, I had one that just touched me so much was a girl wrote, and she said, I'm sitting here with my little brother. We're both gay. We're sobbing because we never thought we'd ever hear a mom say, I love you.
Oh my God.
So, you know, to me, it cost me $11 for a URL and a lot of elbow grease and a lot of coordination, but so many moms stepped forward and said, are you kidding? I will love these children. And I will, you know, and we had one, I know one guy was like a 65-year-old and he wrote and he said, I've never had this in all my life. I hope you don't mind. I'm not a kid, but can I read them too? It was beautiful.
See,
you know,
you created that in 2012. Does it still exist?
Yeah, we've had someone take it every year so far. So, and we have someone for next year as well. So each year those letters are coming in, new letters. And it's so beautiful to see what's possible. If you just think outside the box, if you see a child who's not being loved by their own mom, well, do something, for God's sake.
Well, while it seems so obvious to you and to some of us, on the other hand, you have your work cut out for you. I mean, you'll never not have a project based on how we live our lives, right?
Yeah. And, but that's also the joy of my creative life, is to create something that makes an impact. And I've learned how to do that with, I can't do these, it won't go viral with just me. Other people have to join in, and there's ways to learn to do that. There's ways to design it so that it goes viral, or at least more viral than it would otherwise. And finding the community and saying, our community needs to get together on this. And, you know, even with your holiday mom, you'd hear moms saying, oh yeah, I want to write a letter. And then they wouldn't have time, or they wouldn't get it in, or what, you know, whatever. And we would say, seriously, you don't have time to write a letter for this, really? And then they go, oh God, of course. Yes, I do.
Is it only Robin who is Be Who You Are Productions, or do you have a staff?
I have an incredible project manager that works with me. And other than that, it's me and whoever volunteers.
And where does your money come from?
I teach online my shamanic apprenticeship. I have anywhere from 30 to 60 students for a full year. And then I also work privately with, you know, top level leaders who are in crisis.
Give me an example of that.
So a scenario is someone who's on their top of their game, say that they're, you know, running a large company and they have done very well and they are suddenly hitting some kind of internal dearth in their inner life. Perhaps their partner has left them. Perhaps they're, you know, they've done something that would be problematic and they're afraid of that being found out. Mm-hmm. Who knows what sets off any crisis for any of us. Mm-hmm. These would be people who their lives and the work they do are affecting our lives, yours and mine, in some way. And so I take them on for 6 months and I work with them behind the scenes as a shaman every day for 6 months. We talk a couple of times a week and we basically do a whole life makeover top to bottom.
Wow.
Yeah, it's very intensive. I can only take two people at a time. So it's obviously not that many people over the course of a full career. That's why I choose people very carefully. But you know, to me, it's the greatest leverage of my talents because their lives are affecting our life.
What's on the horizon for you in terms of projects?
Well, I am finishing one of my social change projects from 6 years ago. I've gone back to. It's a trilogy, a YA trilogy called The Maiden Chronicles. And I wrote it in real time as a blog when I first wrote it, with all of those ugly little, you know, typos and everything in it, so people could see, young people could see what a first draft of an author really looks like. And I made videos on the writing process. And now that actual website is taken down, but I'm finally going back and finishing the book, not just first draft, but in actually creating a trilogy. So that's my creative project right now.
Robin, you've got a lot on your plate, and aren't we so grateful for that?
That's so nice of you. Thank you.
And it has been nothing short of my pleasure to get to know you and to meet you and to find out all about Robin Rice. And keep at it. I know you will, because we need the Robin Rices of the world.
And we need far more than just me. Everybody, take up your cause. You know, we've got so much. We've got so much available to us. We've got videos. We've got audios. We've got, you know, websites. We've got mailing lists. We've got everything available. Just go out and do it.
You make it seem so simple. And I guess maybe that's what the problem is for people. They have these great ideas, but then they're afraid to implement them, or they just get stuck, or they can't steal home, you know?
Well, I'll tell you, the number one thing that gets in the way is being worried about what people will think of you. And you know what? It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what they think of you. If you're doing something that absolutely matters to you, there will be people who like you and there will be people who won't. And do it to the best of your ability. Challenge yourself. Give your very, very best, and you'll be engaged regardless of what anyone else does. I've been disappointed many times in reach or in any of those kinds of things, but I do it anyway because it's, you know, I mean, that's what we do when we're creative. That's our creative life.
You can't stop it. It's in you. It has to get out.
Yes. And your life will be so much happier if you give yourself away. I can't even tell you. You'll be so much happier. Everyone.
Well, then that's the way we should end, on that note. Robin, it was really a pleasure to get to know you, and I want to thank you so much for having a conversation with me.
Thank you so much, Sandy.
Join us for another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein.